A good friend of mine who's actually here today, his name's Don. He invited my son and I to go to a banquet over at Calvary on the Beltline and to hear the winner of Alone 2 speak. And so we went and we listened to David McIntyre speak and share a message of the gospel that was so powerful. It began to penetrate and it began to move me deeply. And as I looked around the room at hundreds and hundreds of men that were in the room, all of us were being moved, not just because there was a story being told, but because God was on the move in that place. And so it's been with expectancy that we're praying this morning that for you in your place, for you in your own story, for you right where you're at here today, that God will meet you here. That's been our hope and our desire. And so I'm going to get out of the way and let God do his work through David McIntyre, but I want to introduce him. David McIntyre, many of us know him because we follow Alone and we've watched Alone and we know the story of Alone. He'll share a bit of that, but he's got more than that to share here this morning. He lives in Kentwood, Michigan, is the international director at Set Free Ministries and does work around the globe because he loves God. And he loves people. And so with nothing more to actually that needs to be said, let's welcome David McIntyre here. Welcome, David.
Thanks, brother. It's all right. Well, today I'm going to tell you my story, but it's not about me. It's about him. Amen. There's two things I don't want you to take away from this story. Number one is he survived 66 days living off the land on Vancouver Island. He must be a strong man. That is not the case. The other thing is that if you do business with God, if you're serious about your relationship with him, that he's going to cut you a big check. That prosperity gospel thing is not a thing. That happened in my case, but that was a unique outlier in my life, that's for sure. Winning $500,000 in what people call Olympic Games of Wilderness Survival is certainly a mountaintop moment in your life. There's very few things in my life which compare to it. It's that singular diamond, that sparkling, shining point. Now, if you go to a jeweler and you buy a diamond, he's not going to take that diamond and lay it on a glass countertop, is he? He takes a piece of black velvet and he lays it out. And he puts that diamond in the middle of that black velvet to give that contrast. So that one moment shines, that one diamond shines in the buyer's eye. Now, my story is kind of that way. My winning alone is that bright diamond moment, but it's laid on a very dark backdrop. And that's the rest of the story I want to tell here tonight. I grew up in eastern Pennsylvania, hunting, fishing, trapping, doing all that kind of stuff that boys do. I was kind of a wild child. At 16 years old, I was growing marijuana in our back 40 back there and stealing other people's drug plantations, and I was kind of a mess of a kid. My sport was shoplifting. One year, I did all my Christmas shopping with the five-finger discount. I'm, oh, beautiful sweater, David. Where did you get this? It's like, I got you, Mom, you know. That was the kind of kid I was. I started going to a Bible study with Young Life. It was Young Life is an organization that works with public school kids, and they meet in homes and things like that. And there was a girl I was interested in, and she was always nice to me, this girl. And I was such a mess of a kid. I was rude. I was, you know, not a good kid. And this girl was always nice to me, and she was really pretty. And she went to this Bible study, so I started going to this Bible study. And I was the kid who's sitting in the back making problems for the guy up front. I remember at the end of the school year, Brad, our leader, was talking about the crucifixion. And he was describing in clinical medical detail what it means to die of crucifixion. And I was sitting in the back like, who cares? This guy Jesus. I mean, how many people did the Romans crucify? What makes this guy any different? You know, and I look around the room and there was, you know, I see Pam, this girl I was interested in. She's got her head down. I can see she's crying, real tears. And there was other people in the room that were affected that same way. And then there was people like me. I didn't care. And I realized there's two groups of people here. There's people that think of Jesus as their best friend, and these people are hearing about the murder of their best friend, and there's people like me that it makes no difference to. And that was the first time I started taking note of Christians and Christianity. Now, things at the McIntyre home are not that good. My father was a brilliant man. He was an engineer for Boeing Helicopters, but he drank a lot. And when he drank, we took the brunt of it. And at 16 years old, I decided I'm running away from home. And I knew if I left from Pennsylvania that they were going to find me and bring me back. But if I left from Colorado, where Young Life had this trip out to this camp in Colorado, if I went out there and left from there, then I had a chance of getting away. So I signed up for this trip out to this frontier ranch out in Colorado. And I went there with the full intention of leaving. And I remember the first day I was there, my stuff was on my bed. It was all messed up. And I came back into the cabin and somebody had cleaned up all my stuff. I was angry. I'm like, they went through my stuff. They're looking for my drugs. And I didn't bring any. You know, because I knew they'd kick me out if I brought drugs. And I was really irritated. I trusted nobody at this point. So the next day, my stuff was all a mess. And I left a $10 bill where if anyone straightened up my stuff, they'd find that $10 bill. So I come back and sure enough, my stuff's all straightened up. And I can't find that $10 bill. And I'm like, yep, these Christians are just like me. They're just like me. And I picked up a novel I had there, a paperback, and I riffed through it. And sure enough, there was that $10 bill tucked into the novel. And it made me angry because I would have stolen that $10 bill in a heartbeat if I had seen it. I would have. That was mine. And these Christians were not like me, and they were being nice to me, and I couldn't get it. I mean, this is bait for something. There's a hook in this somewhere, but there was no hook. I couldn't find the hook. I couldn't find the reason they were trying to get something out of me, so I started listening. And one of the nights towards the end of the week, the man was up there preaching, and he said, well, I learned a few things that week. Number one, that Jesus was God. 16 years old in the United States of America, I had never heard that. Number two, I learned that he was sinless, that he didn't die for his own sins, he died for mine. 16 years old in the United States of America, no one had ever shared that information with me. Maybe they had and I wasn't listening, but that was the first time I got that message. Number three, that he had a plan for my life and he was my creator. I couldn't believe that. I mean, my dad was very upfront about telling me I was an accident. And I always thought I was just like an extra human being on the earth that I don't matter. Nobody planned for me to be here. What's the point? Well, that night the man was preaching, he says, I was driving down the road and I see Jesus up ahead on the road. I think this is my chance to do something for God. So he pulls over, he says, Lord, hop in the back, I'll take you anywhere you want to go. And the Lord says, no, I don't want that. He's like, right, he's God. He wants to sit here next to me and be my co-pilot and navigate for me and make sure I don't break the laws and make sure I'm safe and all that. He says, Lord, hop here in the front. You can be my co-pilot. He says, no, I don't want that either. He's like, well, what do you want? He says, I want you to get over in the passenger seat, give me the keys, I'm taking you somewhere. And you're going to trust me because of who I am. I'm not even telling you where we're going. You're going to trust me because I created you for a purpose and you can't get there unless I take you there. You can continue to drive and make a mess out of your own life, or you can move over and trust me completely with everything you are, everything you have, everything you will be because of who I am. And I went out of there that night, and that made so much sense to me because here I was running away from home, in drugs, crime, just a mess. And I prayed for the first time. I said, Lord, I am a hopeless sinner. For 16 years now, I've proved just what a mess I can make out of my own life. It's time for you to come into my life and make out of it what you want to make out of it. And he did. That was age 16. At the same time in my life, I really got into wilderness survival because out there in the bush, I was in control. If I was at home, I had to deal with my dad. If I was out in the mountains, I'm king of the hill, literally. You know, I can do whatever I want out there, but I made a lot of mistakes. And learning how to survive in the bush was something that really lit a fire under me because, number one, I felt safe out there, and number two, I felt free out there. And it was that combination of being safe and being free and being completely, you know, on my own really lit a fire under me. So I started studying wilderness survival. That became a passion in my life, but so did Jesus Christ. And those two things became the rails of my train. My love for Jesus Christ and my love for the wilderness, and they go all the way through until this present time. in my life. Well, we're going to fast forward a little bit. I get to Baptist Bible College, and I started dating a girl who had been a missionary kid, and we ended up getting married and spent 2 years on the mission field from 1990 to 1992. I taught missionary kids in Belo Horizonte, Brazil. Now, who here has heard of Belo Horizonte, Brazil? My son is here. Yeah, he was born there. Yeah. Okay. We got one hand, I think I saw, other than my son. Belo Horizonte, you've heard of Finland, right? The nation of Finland. Finland has 5.5 million people. Belo Horizonte also has 5.5 million people. It's the third largest city in Brazil, 5 hours due north of Rio de Janeiro. And I was there for 2 years teaching missionary kids and decided at the end of that, I knew God was calling me to be a missionary in Brazil. So I said, yes, you're calling me to missions in Brazil. I'm going to go home to the States and be a Christian school teacher. Okay? Never do that with God. Okay? He has a plan for your life. And I went back to the States, and it was probably at the worst Christian school you'd ever imagine. The ministry aspect was fantastic. The administration of this school was very, very abusive. And, yeah, long story short, I decided I bent the knee and I said, Lord, okay, you want me in Brazil. And I was at the retreat. We took all the kids from the school to this retreat, and the man preached on Moses' 5 reasons why he couldn't go back to Egypt. And in the end, Moses says, Lord, please send somebody else. And when that preacher said that, I was just, I can't say that. Okay, you're sending me. And I remember the very next day, I'm directing, we're dropping the kids off after this retreat, and I'm doing traffic, and I'm standing there, and there's a bus right next to me. And the bus window slides open, and this old, old black man looks out, and he says, young man, you look very troubled. I said, well, I told him the story. I said, now I have to go out and give up regular employment and go off and raise support to be a missionary. And he says, I was once young, but now I am old. But I've never seen the righteous forsaken nor their children begging for bread. Mic drop. Exactly what I needed at that moment. And my life's been like that. He is there in the moment, at the moment, exactly telling me what I need to know and showing me he's in control. So I left that school. We candidated with our mission. That was 1995. And I had to do a 2-year pastoral internship. I'd become ordained Baptist pastor. And it was during this time that when we lived in Brazil, our first child was born, Aaron. We moved back to the States, and during this time, our second child was born. I did a 2.5-year pastoral internship, went all around the country, East Coast, raising support to be a missionary. And in 1999, we were ready to go, and we had everything. Our second baby in tow, Karina, and we launched off for Brazil in 1999. Now, Belo Horizonte is 5.5 million people. It is a urban center, and our church that we were going to be working with was a downtown urban church. And I had to do a 1-year internship at that church. I had to do a year of language study with a personal tutor. What I'm saying is there's like a 10-year period of my life being prepared to begin to do what we did in Brazil. It wasn't like you decide to be a missionary and you get on a plane and you take off and go do it. About 3 months into my first term there, my father-in-law, who was still on the field there, he saw that I was falling apart, and he's like, you got to get out of this city. And we drove about an hour south of Belo Horizonte, and I realized this entire city is surrounded by wilderness. You drive an hour south, and you're in the Mata Atlântica, the Atlantic bush, and we found a place where you could park at this ranch, and if I went down in the valley during the rainy season, it was jungle, rainforest. And then if I went up elevation in the dry season, I was in desert. Can you imagine a place where you can park at different times of the year and go to a rainforest in one part of the year and a desert in the other part of the year? And above that were mountains that went to 6,000 feet. And they have a whole different ecosystem. The tropical alpine ecosystem starts at about 4,500 feet and goes to the top. And it's totally different than... I had 3 climactic zones in that one spot. I was in wilderness survival heaven. I mean, everything I wanted to do, I could do. And of course, I was a youth pastor at the time. I'd go out whenever I could. I'd go out to this area called the Waimea Forest, and I'd just blow off some steam and do my survival stuff. And of course, I showed my kids, the youth group kids, these pictures. So this is going back to 2000 now. I show the kids the pictures of where I'm going, and they're like, "Oh, Pastor Mac, you got to take us out there." And these are city kids, literally have never stepped off the pavement in their lives. So I think I'm all enthusiastic. Okay, I'm going to bond with our kids, you know. And I get some gear together, and I take them out in the bush for a couple days, and it was an unmitigated disaster. They did stupid things. They didn't know how to control themselves and the dangers that they were facing. And I'm just a worrywart the whole time, thinking one of these kids is coming home with a toe tag on, you know. And I'm worried the entire time. And finally, nobody died, and we get them all home, and I'm like, never again. And they're going around showing all their friends the pictures and stuff, and, you know, they're like, "Pastor Mac, you got to take us out there again." And I'm like, okay, here's the deal. I'll take you out, but I'm going to take you out to teach you how to survive in the wilderness. I'm going to teach you all the things you don't know about how to live out there, okay? So I got some gear together, and I took a group of like 6-7 guys out there. We get out to the bush. The first thing I told them, this is not at a campground anymore. We're going into the jungle. And I said, "Guys, look around. Do you see your mother here? I am not your mother. I'm not here to process your water. I'm not here to chop your firewood. I'm not here to build your shelter. I'm here to teach you how to do those things. This is the way it works. I'm going to do a thing. You're going to watch me do that thing. And the very next time that thing has to be done, you will be doing that thing. So pay attention. You got it?" And it was great. A light bulb goes off in my head. You're a missionary. That's exactly what you're supposed to do here. You can't evangelize 185 million Brazilians, but you can train Brazilians to do that. You can reproduce yourself in them. And that gave me a focus for my ministry. It also started the Perardua Wilderness Ministry. Now, Perardua is Latin for through difficulty. And it's also the McIntyre clan family motto. The Royal Air Force also uses Perardua, but I think we had it first. You know, so I'm sticking with that. Through difficulty. As a McIntyre, I know that our clan makes all of our own difficulties. We don't need anything from the outside, you know. A lot of alcoholism and stuff going back. I'm come from a long line of human pickles. Anyway, the Perardua, I know that the bush, you don't need to add stress to the wilderness. The wilderness is the perfect classroom. Cause and effect happen instantly. You literally make your bed and then you lie in it. You know, if you don't do the work, you don't get the results. And Perardua became like a rite of passage for all of the kids in the different churches that I worked with. There was the kids who have gone out to the bush to suffer with Pastor Mac, and the ones who hadn't. And the ones who hadn't really wanted to go. So it was, there was literally a waiting list to go out on Perardua. I would use wilderness survival training as a springboard for spiritual development. And everything we did out there had a spiritual purpose. One exercise we would do is the last, when we're leaving the river valley and hiking out, one kid would draw straws, and the guy who got the short straw had to wear all the packs. Now, the packs only weighed about 20 pounds, but when you get 6 of them on, you're overburdened. And all the other kids would be joking, you know. And then we start climbing out. And on the trail, it breaks out into sunshine up in the higher elevations, and that kid's starting to die. He's struggling hard. Now the other kids aren't laughing. They're like, "Pastor Mac, can we get our packs?" I'm like, "No, you can't." And then there's a shady flat spot up ahead we're going to stop at. But he's being tortured, and the other kids do not like it. And they're like, "Come on, Pastor Mac, let us get our packs." And finally they get to the top, and I say, "Why am I doing this? What is this?" I say, "Guys, this is the average church right here. This is a church where you've got one person or one small group of people carrying all the load, and everyone else is just having their burdens lifted and borne along. And they're oblivious to that team or that person. Don't let this be your church." You know, it was things like that that left a lasting mark or impression on these young men and women. Later towards the end, we were taking girls out there. I had some female leaders that were willing to go out and do this again. And ministry in Brazil was fantastic. Life in Brazil was very hard. We saw a lot of kids getting saved. My youth group grew explosively at the church where I was at. During our time in Brazil, we lost all of our coworkers. One by one, everyone dropped out. So we were supposed to be a team of 5 couples. We ended up being there by ourselves. the dollar lost 55% of its purchasing power against the Brazilian real. Where would you be right now if you had to take a 55% pay cut with no way to get another job? We went through that. We lived in a war zone. There was at one point the local gangs all got a hold of hand grenades, and all the cool kids were carrying real military hand grenades. And they get in a fight with each other, and the grenades would start going back and forth. My butcher shop got blown up by a hand grenade. Okay? Neighbors killed, beaten to death, stabbed to death, shot. Gunfires hit our house with the wall outside of our house. It was that kind of a place. Very stressful to live in. The worst thing that happened, though, my 13-year-old daughter was, my oldest was acting kind of strange, and my wife decided to poke around in her room and read her diary, and she's, you know, 13 years old. She's talking about kissing this boy and that boy, and then all of a sudden she mentions two guys that were 28 years old, and you had been grooming her and acting upon that. I'm not going to go into great detail here, but it's as bad as you imagine. And we presented that to our mission and our sending church, and we weren't believed because these two guys were associated with our mission and were known people, two 28-year-old identical twins. And that put a major stress on us, and we were not believed. The McIntyres had an out-of-control daughter and didn't get the support we needed. And I remember taking her to therapy every Monday to a different city, and 2 years of that. Every Monday I'd sit in a parking garage for an hour and a half waiting for her to get out of there, and it was helping. It was going along good. And then 2 years after that incident, she went across the street to help out a single mother. And we lived in a very nice neighborhood, and this family was actually their father. The man of the house was a coach for a major league soccer team. You know, it'd be like having the coach of the Philadelphia Eagles live across the street. And that's the caliber of family this was. She went over to take care of a mother who had a migraine headache and was watching her little boy, and there was no one else in the house. And we didn't know it, but this girl had a half-brother who was on the run from killing a federal police officer. And he jumped the wall of their house, his mother's house, looking for money, found my daughter there alone, and he raped her. And again, the mission that was just taken is more evidence that the McIntyres had an out-of-control daughter and she's making up stories. They didn't believe, my sending church didn't believe it, and it created a huge problem for us. We went home on furlough, and I don't want to cast aspersions on people that I've reconciled with, but it was not a good scene. And we ended up going back to the field. I had no business going back to the field. At this point, I was so beat up personally. My wife and I were just, the marriage was being destroyed rapidly. Went back to the field, and I just went through the motions. I should not have been there. I should have pulled the plug, but I didn't. And the upshot of that, in 2012, my wife says, "We're getting a divorce. This is it." And she wanted to be near her parents, who lived in Grand Rapids. So all of a sudden, I find myself living in a single-bed apartment here in Grand Rapids. I got a job inspecting foreclosed homes. And I felt like my life was over. Everything I'd worked for, everything I'd done, all of a sudden is just gone. And I got that job inspecting foreclosures. It was good that I wasn't dealing with a whole lot of people, just going from one empty building to the next day after day. And finally, the company came to us after a year and a half of this, just at the point where my self-identity, I'm the guy who inspects the foreclosed homes. They came to us and said, "We lost the contract for Michigan. We're done. And you're out of a job." Oh, you know, I couldn't win for losing at that point in my life. Not long after that, I get a Facebook message that says, "You look like a great candidate for a show. Could you apply?" And I'm like, okay, what is this thing? I open it up, and they said, "We're going to send you somewhere in a wilderness area, somewhere in the world. You'll be completely alone, cut off from the outside world, no resupply, no communications with the outside world, no camera crew. You will self-document your adventure by yourself, living off the land in a wilderness area. Could last up to a year. Last person standing wins $500,000. I'm like, I can do this. Yep. I sign up for this thing. And to me, it was, they were talking a Hail Mary pass at life, you know? I'm going to put this message in a bottle out there and see what happens. And I got a call back. They were interested in me. And they wanted to talk on the phone. Then they wanted a Skype interview. And then I get this big background check. And I'm like, wow, these guys are serious about me. And, you know, make a long story short, in August of 2015, I get invited to boot camp out in New York for the Alone Show. Now, 3,500 people applied for season two. Out of that, they take 20 people to boot camp selection out in New York. And out of that, 10 people get to go on the show. So I get invited to boot camp. This is a coin toss now. It's a 50-50. Rather than one in 3,500. And I go out there and I sign the non-disclosure agreement and they tell you all about the show and I'm like, I have to do this. This is amazing. They're doing it for real. There's no back rubs and barbecue on the beach with the cameras off. There's no, hey, let's come back, get a good shower and a good meal. You're doing it for real. And I'm like, Lord, if you don't want me on this show, don't let them offer me a position. It's that simple, because you brought me here. If they offer me a job, I'm going to take it. And I'm going to do this thing. So I said, well, if you don't want me to do this, just pull back and let me fail. Because I know I can do nothing without you, so just pull back and let me fail. And it's like the exact opposite happened. I was the only person in our group of the 20 people to do everything they asked us to do in the field portion in the time allotted. And all of a sudden, I'm the guy to watch. When I got there, I was very intimidated. I see guys like Jose Amoedo, who had been the bodyguard of the King of Spain, Spanish Foreign Legion Special Forces. He lives in the Yukon and has been adopted by an Indian tribe. Dr. Nicole Apelian has a master's in marine biology from the Pacific Northwest, lived in Africa with a sand bushman and hunted poachers or something like that. I'm like, okay, tough girl. There's Justin, who was an Army sniper. Randy was an instructor with one of the Boulder Outdoor Survival School, major school out west. And there's me. It's like, hi, I taught kids Bible in Brazil. You know, I just felt like a total lightweight. But there I was, the guy to watch. So after boot camp, they Skyped me and said, okay, we're giving you a position as one of the 10 contestants. They take 10 people and two alternates. And I was one of the 10 cast members. So, wow, I had a month to get my stuff in order, buy all kinds of gear. You have to outfit yourself for the show. They don't give you any of the equipment. They give you a list of stuff you need to bring. And I spent the last of my money on gear for the show. 2 days before I go to Vancouver Island, I'm stopped here in Hudsonville, no less. I stopped at a stoplight, and a guy rear-ends me going like 45 miles an hour and totals my Jeep. So I got no money in the bank. I've got no vehicle. And I go off to Vancouver Island, and they have camera training and communications training. You learn all the rules that you have to follow and things. And then it's drop day. And the next morning, I'm going to drop off in the bush. And I got up at 4 in the morning. I didn't wake up at 4. I didn't sleep at all. It's like the night before deer season when you're 12 years old. You know, it's like, I'm doing this thing tomorrow, you know. And I got out of bed, and I knew I couldn't take my Bible. Now, I don't believe in Bible roulette, you know, where you rip through the Bible and put your finger in there. My Bible was opened up, and it just kind of fell open in the middle, which happens to be Isaiah chapter 40. And in my Bible, the title in the NIV says, Comfort for God's People. I'm like, ooh, I could use some of that right now. So I'm going to read this whole chapter, and I did, and it's an amazing chapter. But I totally forgot how it ended. It ends. I get to verse 29. He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall. But those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar on wings like eagles. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. And I wept. I said, Lord, that's what you're telling me? This is the last message you're giving me from your word before I go out there and do this thing. And this was not my first rodeo. I've starved in the bush many times. But never open-ended, never for however long it's going to be, never not knowing, never completely alone with no communications. I knew what I was getting myself into, and this is the message he gave me. And I got my rain jacket, my Gore-Tex rain jacket, and I turned the hood inside out, and I got a pen, and I wrote these verses out on the inside of the hood because I wanted that right here, covering my mind. And it's still there. It's very faded. You can still make it out. But I couldn't believe that he gave me that promise. Well, then they get me in a boat, and they drop me off in this rocky coast. Now, Vancouver Island is on the Pacific coast of Canada, British Columbia. It gets about 12 feet of rain a year. All right, it's a rainy place. So typical in the wintertime, it gets down to about 35 degrees and raining. And if you know what that's like, I'd much rather prefer, you know, 30 degrees and snowing to 35 and raining. But that's the way it is. It's a seacoast environment. I'd never been there before in my life. And so they get me in a boat, and they drive me about 45 minutes up the coast, and they pull into this rocky beach with this gigantic forest all around it, and they kick you out of the boat, and they say, okay, your camera gear is up in a big pelican case. You'll see a pink ribbon hanging in the trees, and we'll see you next week. Now, they would come out every week to 10 days to check on us, and very brief medical check, because it would be irresponsible if they didn't, right? So what is it all about? Shelter, fire, water, signals, navigation, and food. That's wilderness survival. Now, I don't need to signal help for help. I don't need to navigate out. But shelter, fire, and water that allow you to stay where you are, okay? And then food. Now, you have about 3 weeks to solve that food problem. You've got a survival reserve right here. Your body can't store water, but it is itself a store of food. And you will starve down. You will eat. You literally consume your own body. You're starving. And your body's set up to do that. That first night I had shelter, fire, and water, and then I had to solve that food problem, and I was finding nothing. I'm trying to pattern the wildlife there. I can't see anything, and I remember on day six, I hadn't eaten anything all that first week. On day six, I was praying. I found a really good place to look out over the Cuatzino Sound, and I'm praying, and I said, Lord, you've taken everything away from me at this point. I'm no longer a husband. I'm barely a father. I see my kids once every 2 weeks. I no longer own a home. I'm not in the ministry. I'm not a pastor. I speak fluent Portuguese. I can't use it. Everything's gone. And the only thing I have left to lose is my life and my health. And you've exiled me to a rock on the north end of nowhere in the highest concentration of cougars and black bears on the planet. Obviously, you're doing something, so I'm okay with that. But I don't know what it is. Obviously, you have a plan. You've brought me to this crazy place and this situation. Whatever you're going to do, you know, it's kind of like returning to that salvation experience. Whatever you're doing here, you know, do what you will with my life. And he exiled me and proceeded to starve me down. I tried to get food every which way I could. I didn't catch a fish for the first 2 weeks. I'm out there 2 weeks before I even catch a fish. I lost 35 pounds in the first month. I lose about a pound a day under total starvation, and that's what I was doing. Maybe this is TMI, but I had a normal bowel movement on day two. Didn't have another one until a month later. Nothing in, nothing out. You know, and the crew on med check, if you poke my belly, is it obstruction? I said, no, it's a vacuum. There's nothing there. Now, how do you get fed in the wilderness? There's active hunting and fishing. That's like with a bow and arrow or a gun or a fishing pole, where you're there operating the system trying to get game. And then there's passive hunting and fishing, building traps and setting trot lines and all those illegal fishing methods they have here in Michigan you're not allowed to do. We could do them. We had a special license for that. So I had a gill net, and I made a second gill net out of a rope I'd found. And every time I put a hook in the water, the bull kelp would tear it out. So I'd go out there to check my hooks in the morning, and they'd be gone. I'd lost 7 hooks in the first week, and I realized real quick, I cannot afford to leave them unattended in the water. And every time I'd set my net, it would be filled with bull kelp. It would just strain the ocean of seaweed and kelp, and I have to pull hundreds of pounds of bull kelp out of the net every morning. And it was work with no pay. And I come out about day 30, and I check my net, and during the night, it had collapsed and rolled itself into a ball. And I was just livid. I was just really, really angry. And I wanted to just throw it into the forest and forget about it. And I shut the camera off because I didn't want this ordained Baptist pastor to say things that would have to be bleeped. And that's where I was at. I was hangry. You know what I mean? And I pick up that net, and I'm just so angry. And I look inside the net, and there's an enormous northern kelp crabs tangled up in the middle of that net. This thing has claws like a lobster. It's like food, you know? So I have to untangle the net. So I start untangling the net. And as I'm untangling the net, I'm getting angrier and angrier at the situation. I'm like, I am doing everything I have taught other people to do, and just wave after wave of destruction is tearing it to shreds. And this is your life, isn't it? This is your life. You know, when I was in the Christian school, they said, if you really want your life to count for God, you have to be either a pastor, a Christian school teacher, or a missionary. That's not true. Okay, but that's kind of the vibe they gave. And I had been all three of those things. Any external observation of my life would say, Dave McIntyre wants his life to count for eternity. I've been in vocational ministry my entire life. And I had done everything I taught other people to do. And here I am, literally exiled to nowhere, starving to death. And everything is gone. And it was destroyed. And the Lord had weakened me to the point where he was able to deal with me in the midst of that. And he showed me in the midst of the failing of my marriage. He showed me in the midst of the failing of my ministry. He showed me my contribution to all that fail. And I was too weak to fight him off. All I could do was beg for mercy and ask him to forgive me. And one by one, he brought all these things up in my life. And I'm standing there in the sleet, you know, just crying my eyes out, not filming this, and just having this moment with God on that beach in Vancouver Island where he was just there with me, showing me one by one all the things all the bad things and mistakes I had done, sins, and I had to confess them. You know, I'd never cheated on my wife or nothing like that. There was no violence, but there was a lot, and there was things that I had to take into account. And one by one, he forgave me, and then he stopped bringing things up. And he gave me like a 5-minute break. And then I looked down and there's a whole nother bucket there and it's filled with rot. It's filled with rotten people. People that had done things. People that I wanted to cut throats. And man, if you imagine it as bad as you can imagine it, that's what had happened in my family. And I wanted revenge. You know, do not take your own revenge, but leave place for the wrath of God. It's very easy to do when no one's messing with you. When someone attacks your kid, all of a sudden you got a problem, especially if you're the kind of person that can do something about it. And I had to forgive those people. And one by one, the Lord brought them up, starting with two identical twins. And I realized something. They didn't rape my daughter, they raped his daughter. And they got to deal with him. What could I do that he couldn't do way better? And I forgave them. Now, what did forgiveness mean? It didn't mean I think that what they're doing is right in any way, shape, or form. It doesn't mean I need a relationship with them. It means I'm turning them over to my God. And I'm stepping out of this, Lord. Whatever you want to do. Now, he could crush them or he could save them, correct? What if he wants to make them a trophy of his grace and pour out the same mercy and forgiveness on them that he poured out on me? Well, who am I to stop that, right? Who am I? Yeah, I was offended. My daughter was offended. But you know what? Jesus Christ was offended too. He paid the price for those sins. And it's amazing, this idea of third-party forgiveness, right? It's like, I have offended you horribly. Will you forgive me for that? How does that work? You know, God didn't ask my wife's permission to forgive me. He just forgave me. He paid the price for those sins. He owns all of them. So then who am I to say, okay, Lord, you're going to forgive this guy who hurt my family? Whoa, wait a minute. Let's talk. Yeah, I'm going to insert myself in that process? In that relationship? Where Jesus Christ paid for all of my sins and freely forgave me without consulting my victims. And if he forgives this man, he's not going to consult me about it. He's not going to ask my daughter about it. He's just going to forgive because that's the kind of God he is and that's the kind of price he paid. Amen? So who am I to ask him for forgiveness but not extend it? That is one of the most destructive processes that can happen in the heart of a Christian because we are the forgiven ones. We are the ones who have been forgiven. How dare we not forgive? And forgiveness is not a suggestion. It's a command. And God commanded me there to forgive. And I did. And one by one, he brought those people up. And I had to feel all the pain and all the rage and then forgive and receive all the mercy and all the healing that comes with it. And I felt light as a feather. After that, I was light as a feather out there. And I knew at some point I'm going to go out on a backboard. I'm going to get hurt out here, and they're going to send me home. Well, you end up putting the best of your knowledge, applying it to the best of your discoveries. Okay, and I got out there, I ate that one crab that I caught in that net, and I remember saying to the Lord, you know, when I get out of here, I'm going to an all-you-can-eat crab place. I'm going to gorge myself on crabs. These are amazing. They eat dead stuff that falls to the bottom of the ocean, and they taste like this. They're a miracle. You're eating a miracle. Looks like an insect, but it's a miracle, right? So I eat that crab, and a couple days later, I'm out fishing. I'm standing at the edge of my reef there, and there's all this bull kelp floating on the surface, and I notice this thing over here moving, and it's a northern kelp crab on his back on top of the kelp. And I threw my bait on it, and he grabs on. I pull up on him. He locks into the kelp. I'm fighting him. He's fighting me. We're tugging back and forth. And all of a sudden, he lets go, and I flew him up in the rocks. I caught one of these crabs with a line. I look out, and there's five more within reach. And that night, I caught six northern kelp crabs, and I had my all-you-can-eat crab feast right there in my shelter. The Lord's like, I don't need you to go home for this and pay money. Crabs are free, and I got a whole lot of them here. You know, so he gave me my all-you-can-eat crab feast. But then it's like he turned the food on. I started really getting dialed in with my food and started eating regular meals. I found a place on my northwest coast where it was a tide pool and it had five crabs in it. And I caught all five of those crabs for another all-you-can-eat crab feast. And I took mussels that were poisonous and I threw them in there and that as bait. So I came back the next day, there was five more crabs. I found a slot machine for crabs, where you just put poisonous bait in there and you get crabs. And I started eating consistently that second month. I actually was regaining weight. I was the only contestant to regain weight on the show until season 7. And the Lord did that. I don't show it on the show, but that's what they told me. Well, you apply the best of your ideas to the best of your discoveries, and then you kind of run out of ideas and run out of discoveries. It's not like I'm going to train the sea otters to bring food to me. You know, you're trying to live this day-to-day existence out there. And I found myself doing some interesting things. Like sometimes I'd be sitting there and I'd run off into my past and I'd grab a horrible event from the past and bring it all the way out there to a sunny day on Vancouver Island and experience all that pain and rage. And I'd catch myself, this is stupid. Why am I doing this? Either that or I'd run off all the way into my future and I'd grab some horrible fear of what's going to happen next and I'd bring it all the way into a perfectly good day on Vancouver Island and be worried about that thing. And I caught myself, like, what in the world? Why am I doing this? Right now is extremely important. Right now is the only moment you're ever going to have to live. And we think of this giant past and this big future and all that stuff. And no, it all comes down to this moment right now. Right now is the only time you have to pray to God. Right now is the only time you have to repent of your sins. Right now is the only time you have to meet Jesus Christ. Right now is the only time you have to obey him. And the amazing thing is in that moment, he will give you the strength to do whatever you need to do. And that's one of the lessons I learned out there is he does not give you the strength to do everything you need to do. He doesn't give you the strength for all of your chemo. He doesn't give you the strength to bury your spouse. He doesn't give you the strength to deal with that child who is not all at once. He doesn't give you strength. He is your strength as you abide in him. As you live your life. You know, Jesus said, apart from me, you can do. I'll say it louder than that, folks. Apart from him, you can do nothing. See, nothing looks, it sounds like the absence of expense, the absence of effort, the absence of involvement, but it's not. You can do a lot of nothing and spend millions of dollars doing it in years of your life by not abiding in him. And that's the message he gave me out there is by standing in him every day that he is my strength, he is my perseverance, he is my provision. Moment by moment. I mean, there was one night I came back to my shelter and I had this little tiny fish I had to cook. And I'm standing there and I am gassed. I have nothing. And I'm overwhelmed with the idea of making this fire. And I'm like, Lord, I can't do this. I can't do this. He says to me, his idea. You can put a piece of wood on that chopping block, can't you? Yeah, I can do that. But the thing, and I'm just standing there with the headlamp on and my breath. We'll hit it with the axe. You can hit it with the axe, right? I'm overwhelmed, so I'm practically in tears here, you know. Well, pick one up, put it on the block. You can do that, right? He literally talked me through every step of that fire. giving me the strength to do the next step. Not all of them. The next step, abiding in him moment by moment. That's the way it's done. Well, it turns into Groundhog Day after a while out there, where you're doing the same thing every day. You're filming it the same way. I try to shake it up and film things differently sometimes, but it's every day is the same. And I remember, well, for season one ended on day 56, and you don't know when the other contestants are leaving. And it got down to day 64. I caught this one little fish again, and I was angry about it because I checked all my crab places, all my fishing spots. The high tide's coming back in. I'm going to get stuck on my coast if I don't get out of there. And I'm just really angry that I got this one little tiny fish, and I'm grumbling. I'm sitting there at a place called the fight chair, and I got my pole was down, you know, poked all the way down by the water. I got a bait in there. I'm not filming. I'm like, Lord, I'm not learning anything new. I don't know why I'm still out here. And obviously someone else is suffering just like me. What is going on here? That go down, stand on that rock, and cast into the bull kelp. Again, my voice, my head, not my idea. And I look down, and sure enough, there's a flat rock down there. And I'm like, well, that's dumb. Why would I cast into bull kelp? It's just, I'm going nuts. And I start grumbling again. Go down, stand on that rock, and cast into the bull kelp. I'm like, okay. I'm going to go down, stand on that rock, and cast into the bull kelp. And I go down there, and the waves are washing past me this way, you know. And I see a hole in that bull kelp, and I throw my bait out there, and I land it in there, and it goes in, and it goes back out. And all of a sudden, bam, I'm hooked in the bull kelp. And I'm just going to lose a hook here because I'm being stupid because voice is, you know, never a good thing. And I'm hooked, and the waves come and wash it in, and my line is still going out to sea. And I haul back on the line, and this sea perch comes out of the water like this and lands behind me. And I got my pink-handled prison shank. It was a big nail I had in my jacket. It was tethered to me. And I grab this fish, and I'm shanking the fish, trying to kill it before it falls in the water, and blood splatter and all this stuff. And I'm laughing, and I'm crying at the same time. And I got up, and I set up the camera. I said, people, this is God taking care of me. This is the grace of God. If he takes his hand off of me, I'll fail. And they used that audio, but they did not use that video. That man, crazy man look. So I go back to my shelter and I filleted that fish. I had a 2-quart pot, and half of that pot was filled with just the fillets of that fish. I had a quart of just meat that night on day 64. And could barely finish all the fish and seaweed stew I had that night. So day 65, I go out there and I have a really good day. I caught a bunch of fish and some crabs, had a great meal that night, another one, and I'm thinking, man, if I can keep, and I've been eating well in the last 2 weeks, enough to start gaining weight again. I'm thinking, if I can keep doing this, I'll be out here forever. This is really great. The next morning was day 66, and you guys get to see day 66. So go ahead and play that video. Wake up, and it's really, really cold.
Sitting out in the sunshine, trying to get warm. And I'm thinking, God, if they don't pull me out of here today, you're going to have to encourage me. Because I'm ready for this thing to be done.
I stay with it one day at a time. And I keep that focus one day at a time. I don't try it. And think about how long I've been here or how long I could possibly be here. Good job. Right now, I feel like I'm coming out of the tunnel. I feel like this thing is coming to a logical conclusion at some point.
104 over 72 is your heart rate. Blood pressure. Sorry.
I mean, I can't stay out here forever. I miss my kids amazing, really bad. I mean, I try not to think about my kids, you know. And but I know that they love me. I know that they want me to be out here as long as I can.
Day 66 today.
Wow.
So why are you staying here so long? Anyways,
is it? Why not? Win? Yeah, I would love to win this thing. Of all the people that get a chance to do this thing, I get a chance to do it. You know, of all the people that applied for this thing and maybe got a chance to do it, I get to do it. So yeah, I want to do this. Why go home now? I'm eating crab. I mean, I am eating Dungeness crabs practically every night. Why would I go home now?
So.
You've been a long time out here. You're doing a good job. I mean, it's work out here, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a lot of work.
Worth it?
Yeah. It's, you know, at 50 years old, to be able to do this for this long. And somebody said to me right before I left, boy, 50 hasn't slowed you down at all. And I'm like, yeah, baby. You know, that's what.
Just tell me.
Oh, my goodness.
I don't need this for the world.
I get to go in that boat today, don't I?
You're coming home.
I get to come home. Oh, my goodness.
You get to come home.
Wow, $500,000. I don't even know what to do with it. I wouldn't even know. I'm pretty enthusiastic about figuring it out.
Yeah.
You know, no, there's some things I want to do to help you guys. And, yeah, beyond that, I don't know. I mean, I just have to feel my way through that, survive that.
What a perfect ending to a beautiful day. I gotta admit, I did not expect the day to be ending like this. Oh, wow, this is so cool. Gotta admit, I did not picture myself leaving in a helicopter. First helicopter ride ever. You know, I don't have to stand over that chopping block splitting wood tonight for my dinner. Oh my goodness, it feels so good to know everything's going to be okay. I get to go home. Everyone's at home's okay. You know, to see you again and to, just to know that I get to stop doing all that. This week was just like, it's just humbling, really humbling.
He gives strength to the weary and increases the power of the weak. Even youths grow tired and weary, and young men stumble and fall, but those who hope in the Lord will renew their strength. They will soar out of Desolation Cove in a helicopter. They will run and not grow weary. They will walk and not be faint. The Lord keeps his word. The helicopter lands, and I get there, and I just stay in a cabin for about 5 days so I could reacclimate to being human again and not, like, kill small animals and stuff. And I go in my cabin, I open the door, and there's this picture over the bed. It's a bald eagle soaring over Cuatzino Sound. I'm like, all right, Lord, I get it. I get it. I bought that picture. It's hanging in my house now. But after the show, I went all around the world, country, telling this story, basically. Then COVID came and wiped out a year's worth of meetings for me. And I prayed. I said, Lord, what do you want me to do? And he says, I said, Lord, put me in the line of battle where you want me to be and give me the grace to stand. Then a week later, I was offered the position of international director at Set Free Ministries. I now have 10 primary schools in Uganda. So all that educational experience I had is being used, all the cross-cultural experience. We're building a $5 million high school in Uganda. I have a ministry to 10 prison ministries in Mizoram, Indian, with 1,000 volunteers. Just this last week, I was offered a trip to South Africa to take part with a ministry there that's launching its Portuguese language version of its. There's going to be 45 people there from all over the Portuguese-speaking world. So the Lord just gave that back to me. I haven't used my Portuguese since I left Brazil. And I'm now being offered, you know, this opportunity to work with the Portuguese-speaking world again. He is faithful. He will give you everything you need as you abide in him. And as you walk in him and as you trust him with your life, he will give you everything you need. Not more, not less, but everything. And that's my story, and I'm sticking to it. Thank you.
I never grow tired of hearing. It's the second time I've heard your story, and it was nuanced in a little bit different way this time. So I heard more of the story. And there's certainly, if any one of us had an opportunity to tell our story, we would tell it differently every single time because there's so much to it. But to hear that common thread that you were down to a place, I think the first time you said had $5 left to your name. And your marriage had fallen apart. You lost your ministry. Weren't seeing your kids like you wanted to at that point. And I remember you saying the first time that you're out on that island and just said, Lord, I see two options here. Either I win or you can take my life right here. Because going back wasn't the option. And you had to move forward, but to even see that far in the future. And that idea that God meets you in your right here and your right now. It's what we've been praying about this week, that you would sense that. That he is the God of the right here and the right now. He's the one that said, I won't leave you. I will not forsake you. I'm always with you in your right here and your right now. And so let's thank Dave again for being here with us this morning. Thank you, Dave. And what I'm really grateful for, Dave, you didn't have to. You didn't have to let God use your story. That's where you have a choice, and you chose to say, I'll let God use my story. I'll be vulnerable with my story, even your family's story. So thank you for allowing us to see Jesus this morning here, and we're grateful for that.